I want to say just a minute about what the evening's program consists of. Mayor Matthews will welcome Ambassador Safieh to the city of Santa Cruz. And then Ambassador Safieh will speak to the group after a brief introduction from me. And then we'll have not an intermission, but we will pass the plate, as they say, to take collection. All of the money that's collected during the time between his presentation and the question and answer period, all of the funds will go towards humanitarian relief in the Gaza Strip. So we hope you'll be as generous as possible. If you want to make a check, make it out to Resource Center for Nonviolence or RCNV, and all of the money will go to the Gaza Strip as humanitarian aid. So we'd appreciate your strong support. You can imagine the circumstances that people are living in, and it's really important during these times that Americans express solidarity with the people on the receiving end of the kind of siege that they've been undergoing in Gaza. So please be as generous as possible. I'm not going to go into detail. Thank you. I'm not going to go into detail about the sponsors in a few minutes. One of the things that got lost on the way will be passed out, which is the program for tonight's event. It lists a couple dozen organizations and several dozen individuals whose generosity has made this event possible. And I want to thank them in advance, but please take a few minutes to look at that list. And I suppose it goes without saying, but these events are not possible without the active support of the community. And we really do not take your support for granted. And we appreciate all of you who've come out tonight to hear Ambassador Safieh. There are a couple things, I don't know if there are any left, but we had a few copies of Ambassador Safieh's collection of essays that they'll take a donation for at the table outside. Also, we have a beautiful poster, of which 500 were printed globally, which we're selling. We're asking a $35 donation, and 100% of the money that's raised through the sale of this artwork is also going to humanitarian relief in Lebanon. And this is the first. Naeem Farhat and other local artists begin gathering artwork, and we plan to do a major fundraising auction of premier artwork this fall to raise funds for the Middle East civilian casualties of ongoing war. Then I'm going to ask you to join me just for a minute of silence. Some of you have heard that a good friend of the Resource Center for Nonviolence, Nicola Geiger, passed today. She was a resident at the Resource Center for many years. And it was our normal practice at the annual dinner of the Resource Center that Nicola would ring her bell, which she brought from Hiroshima. She helped to start the Friends World College in Hiroshima, and she's very active in the anti-war movement and the anti-nuclear movement. And she died today, and we want to honor her passing by having just a brief minute of silence. Thank you. Thank you. It's my great pleasure to introduce and welcome Mayor Cynthia Matthews.
Everything together. Well, it's really my pleasure to be here this evening to welcome the ambassador, and both on behalf of the city of Santa Cruz and on behalf of the entire community. And I am pleased to present a mayor's proclamation. I'll just note very briefly some of the points that are included in this proclamation. It notes, first of all, the ambassador's work, previous work as a Palestinian representative to the Holy See, Vatican, and to the United Kingdom for more than a dozen years. It notes that the ambassador was appointed Palestinian ambassador to the United States in October of 2005. It notes that the ambassador has been an articulate spokesperson for human and national rights for the people of Palestine and all people in the Middle East, and we underline all people. Whereas also the ambassador has actively advocated for a diplomatic resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the ambassador is visiting Santa Cruz today as a guest of a number of groups. Scott mentioned that. I'll just mention them briefly because it represents the broad interest in this topic and support for a message for peace. His appearance is sponsored by the Resource Center for Nonviolence, the American Friends Service Committee, the Palestine-Israel Action Committee, the Middle East Working Group, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Santa Cruz Branch, Students Against War at UCSC, and the Church and Society Committee of the United Methodist Church, certainly a broad coalition. So I'm very happy to present this proclamation and to declare this as Mayor Ambassador Afif Safieh Day in the city of Santa Cruz. So. And frosting on the cake, we do this for extremely special guests and visitors. I'm also very pleased to present the ambassador with the key to the city.
Mayor, my wife and I are deeply moved to be with you today in the city of Santa Cruz, a city I visited some 20 years ago to lecture at the invitation of my friend Scott Kennedy and the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Mayor, you have a fantastic city and you have an adorable community, and you have left with us an unforgettable memory. Thank you very much, and it's deeply moving to be with you, ma'am.
We also We also have some flowers for Crystal Safieh, if she'll come up, because I know I've spent the last several days with him, and I know she's earning her keep as we travel from city to city. It's a rare pleasure to introduce Ambassador Afif Safieh to speak to you this evening. Perhaps the most important message that I've learned in 30 years of work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that the Palestinian leadership has come to a very painful concession and recognition that their future lies in large part to finding a peaceful resolution with the State of Israel. And this has formed itself in the expression of a two-state solution. And Ambassador Safieh has been one of the most outspoken, persistent, and convincing advocates of a two-state solution. It's so important when our media is fueling the concept that somehow people's religion or their very nature drives them to war, to understand that in the heat of conflict, in the darkest hour, there are people who bring practical solutions and real options for peace. And of course, the big challenge for us is, why is our nation at best on the sidelines when our assistance in moving towards peace is so important? So join me today in welcoming Ambassador Afif Safieh. Thank you.
Mayor, ladies and gentlemen, each time I'm introduced as an ambassador, I'm tempted to tell the joke that was extremely fashionable in London about the difference between an ambassador and a camel. And the question was the following. A camel can work for 10 days without drinking, while apparently an ambassador can drink for 10 days without working. Now I want to assure you I'm closer to a camel, or a moderately drinking camel. Ladies and gentlemen, I was really moved and impressed by being for the last 24 hours here in Santa Cruz. Not only do you have a delightful city, all the interlocutors I have had were extremely ethical individuals discussing with great responsibilities the issues of war, peace, and international relations. Now, let me tell you, my message to American society was always the following. I'm not asking you to sacrifice a traditional friend, Israel. I'm offering you an additional friend, Palestine. And I always say to American audiences that very few Americans and very few Arabs, as a matter of fact, today remember that the first country to recognize American independence was not France, who, yes, deployed Lafayette and his input and impact was decisive on the battlefield, but it was an Arab country that recognized the first American independence. It was Morocco, ladies and gentlemen. And I always tell American audiences that very few Americans and even very few Palestinians know that after the end of the First World War, when we discovered that we won't be having independence and sovereignty the way we aspired for and the way we were promised, but we will be having foreign domination, we Palestinians then in 1919 would have preferred to have an American mandate rather than a British mandate. And this preference, Mayor, was for three reasons. The first, it was your anti-colonial history and your anti-colonial experience, the founding fathers who defied the colonial rule. The second reason was Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, arriving to the Versailles Conference that terminated the First World War, upholding the fantastic principle of self-determination. And the third reason was that there was then, in 1919, a congressional American fact-finding committee that went to Palestine and came back with the verdict that the Balfour Declaration could only be implemented with massive use of force against the indigenous population. That was Congress then. It's no more the case on Capitol Hill today in similar environments. But ladies and gentlemen, as I told you, I am here to America offering you not to sacrifice a traditional friend, but to accept an additional friend, Palestine. Now, I always say that I never belonged to the optimistic school of thought that promises victory to the oppressed as a sort of predetermined outcome. Alas, history is a cemetery of oppressed people that remained oppressed until they vanished into historical oblivion. And I always invite my audiences, collectively and individually, to help history make the right choice, because history is frequently and often undecided. And I believe today the moral dilemma, the political challenge in the Middle East is the following. Today we either have one people too many in the Middle East, we the Palestinians, or we have a state which is missing and needs to be created. And I invite you, ladies and gentlemen, to help history make the right choice. Now, I personally believe that America is a fascinating society. You are a nation of nations. You are the world en miniature. And today in the international system, we have finished and terminated the era of bipolar system with the rivalry of two superpowers, with the nuclear threat that accompanied it, and with the third world afraid both of superpower possible collision or superpower collusion. Today we live in a unipolar, monopolar world where America is the only remaining superpower. And I believe non-alignment in that particular international system should be what qualifies and characterizes American foreign policy. Why? If America, the only remaining superpower, this nation of nations, the world en miniature, aligns itself on one belligerent actor in a regional conflict, not only does it alienate and antagonize and offend other actors in the regional conflict, but it also antagonizes, alienates, and ghettoizes a domestic component of your domestic national social fabric. And believe you me, as an observer intimately knowledgeable of American society, believe you me, it wasn't easy throughout the last six decades to be a Palestinian American, to be an Arab American, or to be a Muslim American. Why? Because your country of adoption was insensitive to the ordeal of your country of origin. I really would welcome a more assertive American foreign policy in the Middle East. And I believe we in the Middle East have no problems of values or principles with America, Mayor. I'm extremely comfortable with American political philosophy, with American ideology. And by the way, Dean Acheson, former late Secretary of State, in his autobiography titled Present at the Creation, when he speaks in chapters about the birth of the United Nations that was born close by in San Francisco, he says, the UN Charter is the condensed version of American political philosophy and American ideology. And this is why I don't understand today this phobia about the UN, the UN system, and the aggressive attitudes towards the UN system and the UN Charter. It is the condensed version of American political philosophy. I will not concede from you. I personally believe there are two Americas. Yes, there is the America of the early settlers that has resulted in almost the total extermination of the indigenous population. Yes, there is the America that institutionalized slavery. Yes, there is the America that had an elastic conception of its frontiers and expanded at the detriment of Mexico. That's one America, not your America. Luckily for the world and for you, there is another America, and this does not correspond to democratic and republican America. It goes across the ideological boundaries. There is another America, the America of the founding fathers that defied the colonial rule, the America of Abraham Lincoln that took the painful decision of undergoing a civil war in order to rid itself of slavery. There is the America of Woodrow Wilson that upheld the principle of self-determination. There is the America of Martin Luther King Jr. that had a dream that we shared across the boundaries and across the continents. You are that America. And it's that America that we need, Scott, to address, to persuade, to mobilize for a better future around the world. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I come to you today as the representative of the Palestinian people. And I've always looked at my assignment as though I was the representative of the state in the making and of that stateless society that are the Palestinians. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we are the Jews of the Israelis. We are the victims of European history. And that's the reason why we were deprived of our legitimate share of sympathy, solidarity, and support for so long. And I believe enough is enough. We, the Palestinian people, have suffered three forms of denials. And I'm revolted by any denial. We've suffered, ladies and gentlemen, the denial of our mere physical existence. Zionism was based on the principle of a country without a people for a people without a land. Our mere physical existence was denied. Then our rights were denied and are still are. And then our suffering was also denied or banalized compared to the other one. It is not that important. Well, I, for one, as the representative of the Palestinians, I've never compared the Nakba, the catastrophe, the Palestinian catastrophe, to the Holocaust. For a variety of reasons. One, I don't like comparative martyrology. I believe each ethnic tragedy stands on its own. Number two, I know of no way of measuring pain and quantifying suffering. I know of no way. And I always used to say to Jewish audiences, but also to Palestinian audiences and to other audiences, that if I were born a Jew or a Gypsy, the Holocaust would be the most atrocious event in the history of mankind or humankind. If I were a Native American, it would be the arrival of the early European settlers. If I happened to be an African, a black African, it would be slavery in previous centuries and apartheid in last century. And if I were an Armenian, it would be the Ottoman Turkish massacres. And if I happened to be a Palestinian, it would be the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. Humanity should consider all the above as morally repugnant and politically unacceptable. And I believe personally that we are not children of a lesser God. Our victims do also count. Our tears and our blood does also count. Now, believe you me, as a diplomat today, I appear in front of you ashamed of my profession, diplomacy, and ashamed of diplomats. Why? Because I personally believe that the occurrence of war or repeated chronic escalations of a military nature are a failure of diplomacy and a failure of diplomats. And what we have witnessed during the last weeks was revolting, atrocious, avoidable, and I really have problems understanding how some get away with refusing the principle of the immediate cessation of violence and the quest for a diplomatic avenue. In Arabic, we have a saying which says, an enlightened enemy is much better than a silly friend. And I would like to mention and quote today an enlightened enemy, Dr. Nahum Goldman, who died in the middle of the 80s, but who wrote multiple books and articles because for 40 years he happened to be the leader of the International Zionist Federation. Nahum Goldman, in the middle of the 70s, commenting critically on Henry Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy, and we all remember still Dear Henry, he said, and he gave what I consider to be the most accurate, painfully accurate definition of what diplomacy in the Middle East is about. Nahum Goldman, writing in the middle of the 70s, said, "It seems to me that diplomacy in the Middle East is the art of delaying the inevitable as long as possible." And the inevitable for him already in the first half of the 70s was ending the occupation and the birth of a Palestinian state. He wrote it in 73, 74, 75. We are already, Scott, in 2006, and we are still in square one, struggling to have this achieved. So I personally believe that Nahum Goldman was extremely lucid in offering this painfully accurate definition. Diplomacy is the art of delaying the inevitable as long as possible. And let me tell you, he offered us another piece of wisdom. Because he was intimately knowledgeable of Israeli society and the Israeli dynamics, he knew that Israel and the Palestinians needed external prodding and encouragement, and he knew it could only come from Washington. And he always thought that a more assertive American foreign policy was needed. And he summarized it by an anecdote he had with Moshe Dayan. He tells in his books that one day talking to Moshe Dayan, he told him, "Moshe, the Americans give you much aid and some advice. Up to now, you take all the aid and you leave the advice aside. What will happen if the Americans one day told you you can have the aid only if you took also the advice?" And Moshe, with resignation, said, "Then we will have to take also the advice." So I will not concede from you. I hope that hopefully soon America would be wise enough to link aid and advice to Israel so that we can move. And I hope that there will be an attempt to reconcile American principles with American power in the Middle East. And I'm still, Mayor, intrigued how America can be a superpower all over the world, except in Israel-Palestine, where it seems to be suffering of what I call self-inflicted impotence. America, as you know, and I'm sure you've positioned yourself on that debate, has waged recently two wars which were of a controversial nature, and we're still living with the reverberation, which were predictable, of those two wars. Please wage peace on us. We will be your consenting victim, Mayor. Now, I come to you as the representative of the Palestinian people, and today the Palestinian people lives in lamentable conditions. It gives me pain to describe the situation, and I don't want to inflict on you too many facts and figures. Over 60% of unemployment, over 60% living under the poverty level as defined by the UN as $2 per person per day, malnutrition spreading all over Gaza and the West Bank, a fear when there was the mad cow disease and the bird flu that it might spread like fire in that territory, and especially in that territory, and because of the malnutrition from which the population suffers, it could spread like fire. People spoke at one moment of the Israeli withdrawal out of Gaza, but that withdrawal was not really a withdrawal because they besieged Gaza immediately, did not allow it to have the safe passage with the West Bank for convoys of trucks and buses for people and product. We were not, Mayor, allowed either to fly out of Gaza, even though we had an airport, nor to fish in the territorial waters. It was the biggest open, it is still the biggest open air prison that you have around the world. 1.4 million living in subhuman conditions. In Lebanon today, and I have great compassion for Lebanon, today in Lebanon you have over 800,000 displaced refugees. Do you know what that means? It means over one out of every five Lebanese today is a displaced refugee in total deprivation with nothing except their clothes on their back with them. Today I forgot, I was with Scott, forgot to take my eyeglasses in the morning from where I was residing. Believe you me, it was unlivable the 4 hours I was without. Why? Because it becomes an indispensable tool. I can't even write my phone number, my email to anybody. I can't read the newspaper, etc. I forgot also to take my medication, and I suffer from diabetes, high blood pressure. It comes with the job of being a Palestinian diplomat. And believe you me, the worry of my wife and myself on how to survive the forthcoming hours with the chemical balances of your body to which they are it's accustomed, not being rectified by those medications. Can you imagine 800,000 people with kids and children, etc., with no milk? And I saw pictures of a mother feeding her children water as a substitute to milk because... And they are now in parks, in gardens, in schools, in hospitals, in buildings, which also get shot at and shelled and destroyed and demolished. And yet people are still discussing, shall we have a ceasefire or not? No, give us some 10 more days. We might need some more days to do some cleaning up. So as a diplomat today, Mayor, I come to you ashamed of my profession and ashamed of my what I thought was my vocation. Yet I remain stubbornly committed to the two-state solution because I believe this is the way out. And let me tell you, today around the world there is a general consensus, international general consensus, on what can be and what should be the contours and the content of that desirable peace. What we are missing is the political willingness to move towards that desirable possible end. And I always say, Mayor, to my Israeli interlocutors, and I have many, that a territory that was occupied in less than 6 days can also be evacuated in 6 days so that they can rest on the seventh. So that they can rest on the seventh and we can engage in the fascinating journey of nation building and economic reconstruction. It's the political willingness that is lacking. And let me tell you, I was advised when I arrived never to mention my Francophilia and my affinity and sympathy for De Gaulle. But believe you me, I'm a courageous person with some suicidal inclination. I like De Gaulle and I am nostalgic of De Gaulle, and he used to be a statesman like they make them no more. And De Gaulle, because of his familiarity with the pathology of belligerency and the psychology of belligerence, in 67, called for something he called then la concertation à quatre, meaning the coordination of the major four countries. China was not yet in the Security Council. And in a way, he wanted the coordination of those major four countries representing the international community to tell the local belligerent parties what the world expects from them. Unfortunately, his suggestion never really took off the ground. Why? Because America in 67 was not unhappy with the Israeli military victory. It compensated the humiliations of Vietnam. The Soviets, short-sighted as they frequently could be, preferred the bipolar constellation and didn't see why they should give equal status to lesser countries like Britain and France. The English were unenthusiastic simply because the proposal was French to begin with. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, 38 years later, we still have a peace process but no peace, which is the symptom of its failure. I will not conceal from you, I believe today there won't be peace in Israel-Palestine unless the international community steps in assertively, and why not through the Quartet, which is a diplomatic construction built in 2002 with the USA, the European Union, Russia, and the UN representing everybody else. I believe we know what should be the contours and the content of that desirable possible peace, and I believe through the Quartet, but with America at the engine seat, we should be leading that effort. It's not taking place. Why? Because unfortunately, American foreign policy is not as non-aligned and even-handed as it ought to be. It's aligning itself even further. In the hostilities that were occurring the last weeks, for reasons I ignore, America positioned itself to be seen as though it was the partner in the aggression taking place. And for a diplomat like me, who's supposed to explain the Arab world to America and America to the Arab world, and how to make the Arabs lovable in America and how to make America lovable in the Arab world, my task has become a very difficult job, Scott, my friend. So I personally believe, ladies and gentlemen, that in the coming future, the Palestinian-American community, the Arab-American community, you will be seeing them more visible, more constructive in their engagement. And in my tour of America, I'm always speaking to the Palestinian-American community by telling them, You are living in a fascinating society, a nation of nations, a country which allows that one keeps and preserves and cultivates one identity, and at the same time one can further and accelerate one's integration. The love of the country of adoption is not incompatible with keeping the connections with your country of origin. So I hope, ladies and gentlemen, that in the coming months, years, the Arab American community will be more physically and intellectually engaged in this national dialogue in a much more constructive manner. In matters of community, one has to give time to time, and I believe now is the right time. Now, if they were not sufficiently integrated, it was for the combination of two reasons. Probably they have not been sufficiently assertive through their representative institutions, and unfortunately there is the other factor that they were insufficiently encouraged by the establishment and the components, the other components of society. So, Mayor, I'm sure you can take many a wonderful initiative towards your teeny-meeny minority of Arab Americans, and I'm sure your initiative will receive wonderful echoes, because all they want to is that they want to be better integrated and have a more constructive role in the national life, cultural, political, economic. Let me finish, ladies and gentlemen, by saying that we live bleak moments, and one should always cultivate hope. And I personally believe that today there are three initiatives that could be taken that will change totally the political environment in which we are operating. What are those three initiatives? The first, immediate cessation of violence from all sides. The second initiative, there should be liberation of political prisoners. Yes, Hamas has one prisoner. Yes, Hamas has one prisoner. Yes, Hezbollah has two prisoners. But the Israelis have several Lebanese prisoners who were kidnapped from Lebanese territory some over 30 years ago. And the Israelis have over 10,000 Palestinian prisoners that the media tends to forget. And believe you me, more than 9,000 out of those 10,000 were never, Mayor, engaged in any military activity, legitimate or not, and could immediately be freed. And let me tell you, when I speak of 10,000 Palestinian political prisoners, it means that every city, village, refugee camp, every extended family in Palestine has several of its members in jail behind bars, unnecessarily so. And if they were to be wise in releasing en masse big numbers of prisoners, this will create a positive psychological shock in our society to create the new environment that we need to trigger a credible peace process. So that's the second initiative. The first, mutual cessation of violence. Number two, release of all political prisoners. Number three, I believe the Israelis should immediately take the decision of freeing the freedom of movement of people and products, meaning allow the safe passage between Gaza and allow the free passage between Gaza and the West Bank, reduce dramatically the number of military checkpoints within the West Bank, which is today strangulated as a society, suffocated as an economy by 450 checkpoints that are of no security value. Some of you might be still familiar with Checkpoint Charlie that divided East and West Berlin. We have 450 Checkpoint Charlies that are suffocating the economy, suffocating the society. And in a world where every society is measured by its productivity and by its competitivity, my society loses more than 8 million working hours a day at checkpoints. Not speaking of the moral, physical, personal abuse, humiliation, and oppression that occurs. 8 million working hours every day are lost in delays, unnecessary delays at military checkpoints in the West Bank and in. So if those three initiatives were taken, and they can be taken like that within 24 hours, believe you me, a totally different political environment will prevail, and we can speak of serious diplomacy to find the solutions desired. Some, my friends, unfortunately think that history in the Middle East and history of the crisis started the day the soldiers were captured. No, and some even use the word kidnapped. Language is not innocent. I'm not the linguist, my wife is. But believe me, in a military operation, soldiers are not kidnapped, they are captured. I might consider the event unfortunate, but this event was not the beginning of history or the history of the crisis. It happened in a context, and people tend to forget the context. This is why they never understand the history. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I believe some of the decision makers I encountered in Washington will be well advised, Scott, to enrich their vocabulary by the word occupation. They never think in terms of the occupation. And as long as occupation is not the premise on the basis of which we are operating, we're taking the wrong decisions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. You see what I meant by the decency of your constituency, ma'am.
So, ladies and gentlemen, and let me end by saying, I belong to the secular wing of Palestinian politics, for obvious reasons, out of choice. So I don't belong to the winners of the last Palestinian elections. And I always say, in a democracy, winners and losers have to behave gracefully. And I'm an old-fashioned Democrat. And I believe democracy is made of four ingredients. It's constitutional pluralism, it's the rule of the majority, the respect for the minority, and the last election is not going to be the last election. Immediately, the day after the victory of Hamas, and they scored 44%, Fatah 41%, and all the others 12%, so it was not a landslide. I went to both the State Department and the Security Council, National Security Council, and I told them, with the result of those elections, there are two possible courses of action. We either trigger a credible peace process with emphasis on credible and try to engage a majority of Hamas, and I think they are rare available, or we try to rob them of their legitimate electoral victory, pushing them back to militant military options. I don't need much explanation to tell you that it was the second alternative that was adopted, and I believe it was a precipitous decision, an unwise decision that might lead to disastrous results. I personally believe that a majority within Hamas is ready to be rallied to a credible peace process, and I keep repeating that a week before our elections, the number two person of Hamas gave an interview to Haaretz, which is the most respectable Israeli newspaper, and he said in substance three points. He said the fact that total liberation of Palestine does not figure in our electoral program, this is not a tactical maneuver, it's a strategic shift. Then he said, if we are elected, we will pursue negotiations and might do it better than our predecessors. Then he added, when we speak of resistance after elections, it does not necessarily mean armed resistance. Now, to all concerned, to everybody intelligent and coherent and consistent, this must have been music to one's ears. Yet the next day, the occupation forces came to his house to arrest him, which is still, for me, an intriguing phenomenon. So I personally believe that Hamas is not a monolithic movement. It has a pragmatic school of thought within it. And in politics, it's always how we operate to encourage the right school of thought in every possible camp. I will end by saying that we live a gloomy, bleak moment. Yet even in the bleakest of moments, I was always confident that Palestine will resurrect. And Mayor, as you probably know, we in Jerusalem, we have had some previous experience in resurrection. Thank you.
We will